Hey, everybody, real quick before we get going here, we have something real special for you guys for our 150th full-length episode. Woo! We are doing a little deal for you guys, discount code on the Vortex website. It is for apparel and that kind of gear only. If you head there and you add a bunch of cool stuff to your cart, there's a whole bunch of new awesome apparel items that just came out. Until the end of October 2020, if you use the coupon code POD25, and the key is you have to create an account on there too in order to use it, but you create an account on the website, add all that apparel to your cart, and use POD25. You get 25% off that order. It's a big thanks from us to you for all those who have followed along, or even if you're just joining us now and are new to the podcast, we appreciate everybody for tuning in. Without further ado, though, we got a great one with Mr. Ryan Lampers here, and it came via your request as well for the topic. So check it out. Thanks again, everybody. Welcome to the Vortex Nation podcast, brought to you by lovers of hunting, shooting, public lands, the Second Amendment, and good food. What is up, everybody? Special day today. We are celebrating our 150th episode. Can you believe it, Jim?
Got jazz fingers for
Oh
that.
My gosh.
Actually, I didn't even plan on jazz fingers. It just happened.
Spontaneous jazz fingers. Super stoked. And we're celebrating this with a listener special. So we polled the audience. We did a survey. And we said, what do you guys want to hear more about? Which actually, by the way, that's all the time. So if anybody's got an idea of what they want to hear about, please let us know.
Yes.
But this one, you guys...
Pretend this one was really special.
Pretend it's really special. You guys for sure decided the topic. And it's a good one. And it fits the time period that we're in right now. We are in kind
perfectly.
Of the heart of fall. You know, a lot of archery seasons have been going on. I'd say a lot of rifle seasons are about to kick off. We've got, I mean, we are in the thick of it right now. Mm-hmm. We are in the thick of it. And the topic that you guys chose was meat care. Meat prep, meat care. How do we get it from the animal, you know, to our house or to the butcher, possibly even, you know, a few steps beyond that. And it's such a good topic because oftentimes, even on our podcast, we focus on how do you get one? You know, what's the tactic? Where do we find that bull? How do we call that bull in? Or how do you stalk a mule deer? Speaking of which, we did an excellent podcast with Remy Warren and Ryan Lampers on early season archery mule deer, if you're interested in that. So this is a really important step in the process.
Yeah.
One of the most important steps in the process.
I'm surprised in 150 episodes, too, we haven't, like, really
dove
straight into it.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
Who better to have, though?
Yes.
Than the guest at hand here across the table from us, virtually speaking, Ryan Lampers himself.
Mr. Ryan Lampers from Hunt Harvest Health.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of other things. I'm just going to go ahead and say it again. I probably said it before. Expert hunter, because Ryan, you are an expert hunter. Let's just face the facts here. He's smiling. He's being humble. But Ryan, if you can, for anybody that's not familiar, introduce yourself. Maybe tell us a little bit about what you have going on. And then we're just going to really dive in to this topic of meat care.
Yeah. First off, thanks for having me on, guys. Yeah, the 150th episode. That's pretty cool.
A lot
you
of pressure.
Crush it. Not that far. Yeah, so I guess Ryan Lampers, I grew up Northwest, always have been, grew up in Washington State, kind of your old stomping grounds, Mark.
Yep,
that's why Mark then, likes you so much.
Yeah. and so I spent most of my life over there. I'm getting old. And so I spent 44 years of my life in Washington State hunting that type country. Met my wife when I was in Alaska. 25 years ago now. We've been married for 23 and got a couple of daughters. And since then, we've had a great, great journey. And somehow we found our way into Montana, which is where we reside now. A great place to raise kids. It's where my wife originally grew up out of Bozeman. We live 30 minutes outside of Bozeman. And holy smokes, I can't believe I didn't make this move 20 years ago. It's been amazing. It's just an outdoor playground for a sportsman. Pick a direction. You got a mountain range to go play in and learn and explore and hunt and fish and whatever. So we find ourselves here these days, and I'm very fortunate in what I do. And My wife is the smart one. She's a doctor, and I am not. And I am a hunter, and we do a podcast ourselves called Hunt Harvest Health. And we got, you know, some products and things like that that we work on, and that's kind of where we find ourselves right now. So I'm very fortunate that I get to spend a ton of time in the mountains chasing big game animals. And I know growing up, it used to be a lot of bird hunting and a lot more fishing, steelheading type things. And now I just find myself really immersed in big game and trying to tackle that challenge. And it's a never ending exploration of all these new ranges and wilderness areas. And man, it's just a great life. And being here in Montana, I feel like this is just the biggest playground of all, and really happy with where we're at.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. Yeah. That's awesome. Jim once broached the question to me. He said, "Mark, you can pick Washington or Montana, but whichever state you pick, you can't go back to the next. You can't go back to the other one. You got to pick."
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I actually chose...
That was a pretty mean question.
It was a mean question. I chose Washington, actually. Now, with the caveat of how I picture it, you know, so many years ago before I left, right? So yeah. I think the times have maybe changed a little bit, but
it was... a pretty cool place. You can go and just make your own country these days.
Yeah, there's that, too. A lot of freedom.
So,
yeah.
King of your own castle.
It was the ocean, though. It was the ocean, yeah, and the salmon and the steelhead, yeah, that I was like, well, I can still hunt elk, and I can still hunt deer, and I can still hunt turkeys, yeah, and waterfowl. A lot of the same things in Montana, not as good. But then you got the ocean, too.
Yeah.
Now, Washington does get overlooked, Mark. You're right. I mean, there's some great hunting. It's different there. There's a higher population of folks, a little less area to hunt, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But you got that ocean, which... You and I both know Joey Pyburn. He spends his days on the water. He loves it. That's where he gets most of his food. But, man, the hunting there gets overlooked, and it can be really good in Washington State. There are some great animals, great areas, high country. It's just a great place for big game, bird, hunting, fishing, really in as a whole. But the problem is, yeah, it is a lot of folks, and it's gotten a little nutty over there lately. So... Yeah. I think I'd have to go with Montana on that question if it was for me, Jimmy.
Well, now you know. All right.
There you go.
There you go, everybody. So speaking of all this hunting stuff, and like Mark mentioned, we got to talk about meat care. Mark and I just got back from a hunt, and it will pop up as one of our pod ventures here in due time. But anyway, we were out in Wyoming doing some hunting for some wild game, if that wasn't already implied. But
not domestic.
We got ourselves just in the position of getting some game down and then having to, you know, get the meat out in the field and pack it out, which I'm sure many people out there are either familiar with, or if you're not familiar with it yet, you're hoping to be familiar with it in due time if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure. And I don't necessarily know if this is a podcast to explain how to make the cuts and how to do this and everything, although that may be part of meat care, but it's more or less how to make sure the meat, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Mark or Ryan, how to make sure meat is staying clean, how to make sure you're avoiding that gamey flavor, you know, by getting it cool immediately, like best ways of getting it in your pack and, you know, things about, do you want to keep air on it? Do you want to keep it sealed up? What do you want to do? Do you want to avoid it being in the sun? Is that a big deal? I mean, there's all kinds of little things that actually go into, you know, you might know how to cut it open, but from there, getting it back to your house or the butcher, like Mark said, there's some considerations there.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack with meat care for sure, right? I mean, there's the breaking it down in the field. There's trying to keep it cool all the way back to trimming it up. And if you want to do all the cuts yourself back home. So
yeah,
just a lot to it for sure. And fortunately, if you spend enough time out there, hopefully you haven't had a bad experience and had meat turn on you or anything like that, but there's definitely some tips and tricks that'll help you not have to have that nightmare down the line for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah. And every scenario is going to be different, right? You know, how far back in are you? You know, how far are you from your vehicle or a cooler or a town that you can get mm-hmm. your meat cool? You know, and every hunt is different too. I mean, you know, Ryan, you hunt everything from, you know, early archery mule deer in August when generally pretty hot, right? Or archery elk season, which is September, which, you know, can be really hot or can be cold or a little bit fickle. And then you've got your later rifle seasons where generally it's a little bit cooler. But, you know, I mean, Jim and I had some doe tags in Wyoming just hunting. We were hunting antelope. And the day actually kind of like was cold. Then actually started to warm up, and we're like, yep, we got to get these things taken care of. And then actually we got some cloud cover. The wind came up and it cooled off for us. But we're definitely still, it's like time is of the essence, you know? And so that's what I want to dive into a little bit, is maybe some of these different scenarios, you know, and how do you go, you know, one that pops in my mind is maybe one of the trickiest. It's warm out and you're pretty far back in, you know, what are you doing there, Ryan, to make sure that game is going to be a really good final product when you finally get home and start eating it.
And does it start too with the shot as well? So, I mean, from the moment you make impact, are you already thinking, I mean, I have to assume you're already thinking about that meat and making sure it gets out quickly and efficiently, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Number one, I mean, you're always, until you get that meat back to the cooler, there's always kind of this pressure, like you feel like a stress come over you when you put that animal down. There's always that stress to get it back to a cooler where it's going to be nice and cool and you don't have to worry about it anymore. But I think number one, it does come at the shot, maybe in a different way than you were alluding to there, Jimmy. But, you know, number one, making that clean shot, you know, one thing over time, over the years, it's so important to make that shot count and make it 100%. First shot. Hopefully there's no gut shot. There's no nothing too far back. That's number one. I know I take a lot of time on my shots and my shooting, and I've got restrictions on how far I shoot just because I want to make sure I'm not getting, you know, the guts or anything like that. And also, you know, I know a lot of guys will say, you know, go for that front quarter, that front shoulder, and it puts them down, and it does. But I'm such a, like, I love meat and I hate to break, I hate to lose any meat. So I don't want to shoot them in the shoulder if I don't have to. And I've really tried to avoid that. Now, obviously there's the argument of it will put them down on the spot a lot of times versus taking that double lung shot, you know, whether that's with the bow or with the rifle. But, you know, with the rifle, I still like to go a little bit behind that shoulder and try to make sure I'm not getting that one shoulder or two shoulders, you know, all bloodshot. And that's a lot of meat loss right there. So I'm always thinking about that, you know, with every shot that you take, it's a consideration because I want all four quarters intact.
Yeah.
And you know, hitting them high, you're going to blow up some back straps. So always just trying to take the extra steps, the extra few seconds to make sure that shot counts.
Well, and the easy situation too is broadside, but then there's also if they're quartering to or quartering away, you may put it right in the pocket, but then it may affect something else on the backside because they unfortunately are, well, not unfortunately, but when you're shooting, unfortunately, they're 3D objects. They're not 2D little printouts of paper, you know. They got other stuff on the other side you can't see.
Yeah, definitely. You always got to imagine a straight line and where that bullet is going to come out or where that, you know, that arrow is going to come out on the other side if you're taking a frontal. It's very important as far as that. Now, I just took a bull that I took a frontal and it was such a steep, it was a 3-yard frontal actually, and it was such a steep angle that the arrow went right through, you know, that center piece, and it was such a steep angle it actually came out his paunch, just
okay,
you know, his belly somehow managed to not hit guts or anything like that. But it was the only shot I had, and otherwise that thing was going to walk right over me. So, but just picturing where that arrow was going to come out the other side and things like that. But yeah, as far as early season meat care, like those August hunts, I mean, those are stressful. I've done a lot of hunts in say Nevada in August and, you know, Utah and Nevada, they've got some real early, you know, I think Nevada is August 10th and then August 15th on Utah. Those are inevitably hot. I mean, you could be dealing with temps from 80 to 100 or 100 plus. And so, you know, fortunately, I still feel like even at 100 degrees, you know, thinking things through, working fast, sometimes it's a lot of night work, which I love night hikes, especially packing meat out. there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, you end up taking a lot of animals in the evening anyway, but holding off and packing that animal out at night really does ensure that you're not just baking that meat. If you got 8, 10, 12 miles to hike out, you might want to think about doing a night hike when the temperatures are going to be at the coolest and you got that thing on your back. So we do like doing that. Well, I'm not going to say we love doing that, but it's just what we end up doing every year. Like on most hunts is night hikes. And you can, you know, sleep during the day once you got your animal down.
I mean, that's a really interesting point, because in my head, I'm like, okay, we got the animal down. We got, you know, we got it broke down. You know, like you said, if you shot it in the evening, that's kind of a long night already, right? If you got it broke down and maybe back to camp or whatever. But to make that effort and drive through and try and get out that night, I mean, you're going to be tired.
Yeah. I mean, for sure.
Exhausted.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like that didn't actually, that's one thing that didn't pop into my head as an option. I'd be like, okay, yeah, we'll get a little couple hours of sleep and then we'll get up early, you know, to take advantage of the early morning coolness, I guess. But that's a good one. I do want to jump back really quick too on that front shoulder thing too, because I've heard people say, well, there's not really that much meat on the front shoulders anyway. And I feel like that's, you know, sometimes a misconception for some folks, because there really is a lot of meat on those front shoulders. I mean, we shot some not giant antelope, and there's still a significant amount of meat on those front shoulders. You know, they're not a big animal. So extrapolate that to a whitetail or a mule deer, or, you know, then you get into elk size game and there's a lot of meat on those front shoulders.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if you're running a 300, you know, WSM or Win or whatever, and he's broadside, you hit that shoulder, you may be taking out two shoulders worth of meat. So definitely like to either hold off and wait till you get that nice broadside. And, you know, double lunging is great. I'm much more apt to take a double lung. They may run a little bit, but usually not very far, even over a heart shot. Because a lot of times on that heart shot, you know, you're blowing out that opposite shoulder. And inevitably, you're going to lose a lot of meat. And that's all preference for folks. But I've just come to that realization that I'd prefer to keep all four quarters and not have any loss. So I do bring that target back a little bit off that shoulder. Mm-hmm.
So going into when you're talking about, for example, even the idea, and correct me if I heard incorrectly, but let's say you shoot in one of those real hot times an animal earlier in the day. Are you saying then to potentially wait to start opening everything up and getting the meat out until that evening time frame?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And is that is that like, I guess, sorry to interrupt, but like I almost get nervous. I know when we've put an animal down, for example, you know, I start getting nervous thinking if that meat doesn't get out of it, that the meat's going to go bad inside of it. And I, you know, there's some stuff with the way the guts kind of expand over time or the stomach expands over time. So, you know, are you getting the guts out and then just waiting to get the meat out until later? Or anyway, I'll let you get in there because you start saying something.
Yeah, for sure. So let's take, for example, let's just take an August 10th hunt in Nevada. Done a bunch of those. Say you take an animal, and a lot of times on mule deer, you end up taking your animal midday. That's usually how those hunts go. It's kind of when they bed up, the thermals are generally consistent, much more so. I feel like most of my animals have come midday versus even early morning or afternoon on those early bow hunts. Rifle's different, but those early bow hunts, it's usually a middle of the day type thing. And again, like I said, some of those temps are in the 90s, even hotter. So, you know, if you're fortunate and you put a buck down, a lot of times it's open country and not much for shade. Number one, it is important to get on that thing ASAP and get that meat off, get the hide off. What I like to do is first quarter it up and try to get it to some shade. And then you can either debone if you're far enough in that you feel like you want to save a little bit of poundage and not pack those bones out. Or if you're a tough SOB and you're just good with packing out extra weight and you want to just pack those quarters out, then great, that'll work too. But number one, what I would do is definitely get that thing quartered up and find some shade. And from there, it is incredible how much of a temperature drop there is from the sun to the shade. We all know this. I mean, it's 20 degrees right when you hit that shade. So getting that animal and getting those game bags hung, you know, in a shade or on a ridge where there's a slight breeze, typically most places that you're hunting, especially early season mule deer, those high ridges, sometimes you're at 10,000 feet, there's usually a slight breeze up there and they get pretty dang cool, especially at night, but there is a significant temperature drop on those ridges. Now, if you don't have that, sometimes it's going down the other way and you're getting down into, you know, some alders or something like that and getting into the creek where the temperature, you know, dips a little bit, but finding shade is key. And then a lot of times what I'll do is I'll get it to that shade and that's where I'll either debone it or decide that I'm going to pack bone out. Now, if it's like a 5-6 mile trip, sometimes I'll pack that bone out because my wife and kids like the bone marrow and you like to make bone broth with it and stuff like that. But then there's the weight consideration. So, you know, you want to save yourself 10, 15 pounds of weight that you don't have to pack out. Then you'll debone and you'll leave those femurs back there. I do like packing out the shanks. It's just easier to deal with and cook up later. Those shank bones aren't that much, but getting the femurs out is pretty important as far as saving weight. And then once you get it all deboned and the meat hung, you know, in the shade, sometimes it's a wait till evening, till that temp starts dropping. And that's when you decide to hike it out.
Got it.
Similar to when you're hiking in on some of those hunts, you know, I would never pick middle of the day to go hike in 10 miles on a high season or early season high hunt. You know, you're just beating the heat, you're sweating, you're losing all your water versus just hiking in at night or early morning when the temperatures are cool. So I'd always use, you know, nighttime for going in and usually coming out as well, if possible, on those early season hunts. So it just makes sense to, you know, try to get those animals packed out in the middle of the night. If you're comfortable with night travel, obviously make sure you got a good light, extra batteries or charging station or all that. But some of those night hikes are pretty grueling. And sometimes, you know, you're getting to the truck at 5-6 AM that next morning, but boy, it's it really kind of takes a lot of the pressure off of hiking fresh meat off the mountain on a 100-degree day when inevitably you're probably going to be hiking through some pretty hot, sunny patches. And it's also sitting on your back, which is hot. And,
yeah,
you know, it just makes more sense. And I've always just tried to do night hikes and get comfortable with that.
Yep.
Is there an advantage to getting that to that meat cooling by getting those bones out? Like, will that help the meat cool and kind of aid in that process?
Yeah, there's kind of two trains of thought on that, right? Like, you like to keep the meat with as little surface area as possible. So it's nice when you can just, you know, take a quarter off. And, you know, one thing that you can do in those hot weather conditions, if it's something you want to pack out, you want to pack out that whole quarter, the femur, everything, what I'll do is I'll just kind of slice down to that bone on the inside of that hind quarter and just kind of open it up a little bit. And you can kind of flay it off the bone and just kind of get that thing broke off the meat, but still leave it intact and attached to the meat.
Minimizing that surface area exposure there. It's still allowed to kind of maybe get that little crust on the outside that's going to protect the meat. So that's a good tip.
Absolutely. And the other thing that you can do is, like, if you do slice it down to the bone on that femur, like you said, Mark, the more air exposure, you're going to get a crust. Now, a couple of those choice cuts, like say the tenderloins, for example, man, I hate getting a crust of those things because you inevitably have to trim it off. So a lot of times on the pack out, what I'll do is I'll just take those tenderloins, kind of lay them inside that cut, fold the meat around it, and then you're not getting any waste. There's a couple of pieces, you know, strap and T-loin. If you can get a wrap around those pieces on the pack out, you just inevitably don't have to trim so much off in the end.
That's a pretty slick trick right there. And the surface area problem comes in with the crust that you guys are talking about that does sort of form on is that you're not going to want to, you're going to want to trim that off when it comes to cooking it, but that,
absolutely.
Okay, got it. So it's basically just getting into it, trying to minimize meat loss.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, and you
there's two trains of thought too, because those larger pieces, they definitely take a lot longer to cool down. But if you can get it into some shade and you can let it maybe hang for a few hours that night before you hike it out, or if you're on an extended trip and you got the other guys in your party and you're going to be up there for a while, you know, typically, you know, you can leave that thing hanging overnight and get that thing in the shade and on a windy ridge or down a cool bottom. And you want that crust. I mean, that's what's going to save you.
Okay.
You know, keeping it dry and getting that crust on that outer piece, especially if you got a whole hind quarter bone in, it's pretty important. But also, you know, if you're way back in there and you do have, you do end up breaking the muscle groups off of that piece to get them cool, you're going to have a little bit of loss. It is minimal, but you are going to have a lot more trimming to do when you get back to the, to your house and you end up breaking it down.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You brought up the scenario that I remember Ryan Muckener, who frequently joins us. Gosh, there's Ryan's everywhere. We got Ryan here. We got MC Ryan. We got Ryan Muckener. Anyway, but Ryan Muckenhern was telling us, you remember that, I think he was on a Sodak hunt or something like that, and he killed a deer on day one of an 8-day hunt with a number of other hunters in his party, and ended up having just the right situations in terms of temperature fluctuations and finding a nice shady area and wind and all that stuff where he was able to hang his deer, the quarters or something like that, for like...
Several days.
And yeah, basically checked it every day, but he was able to have that, you know, the wind and the shade and the temperature fluctuations over the day and night, essentially keep it. He did have to trim some of the stuff off that was on the outside in the end, but ended up working out.
Yeah. How long do you think a person has, we'll just say maybe it's kind of like not an extreme, but like an average temperature hunt where, you know, maybe let's say it's maybe getting into the 70s during the day. But you do have, you're able to hang, you know, maybe it's getting into the 40s, maybe high 30s at night, we'll say. And you do have a shady spot where you can hang some quarters where there's, you know, some air circulating around it. How long can that hang out there without spoiling, would you say? Like, just, I'm not going to hold your feet to the fire because every situation is just so different, right?
Yeah.
But
it is. I would say surprisingly longer than you think. For example, Mark did a spring bear hunt this year. Mm-hmm. And, I was fortunate to take a bear pretty early in the hunt. There was a couple of us and we had four tags. And I took my bear, was able to quarter it that first night. We had a really nice, it was probably low 30s. So a little bit of a freeze that night, which was really important. Took a lot of the worry away. And I got that hung in kind of an area where there's a nice cold creek coming off the mountain, mm-hmm. heavily shaded. Stay shaded all day long. There was no sun ever hitting it. I hung that for, ended up being 8 more days, and the meat was absolutely incredible. But it was that, it's that, the most important is that first night, getting it hung, getting it cool to the bone, and it does start to form a crust, and that's where that crust is important. And yeah, I let that thing, it basically was just sitting up there aging in a cool spot, shaded spot, kind of creek running through it. And it was totally dry. We didn't have any rain or anything like that. So it was dry. It was cool. Hung there for another 8 days before we ended up packing it out. And we took a few more bears between those 8 days. So
yeah,
that's this one example. But I've had them hang for a week many times. And as long as that, you get it cooled down right away. Now, if you're not able to get it cooled down right away, I'd feel pressure to get that thing out of there within a few days.
Yeah.
But I think each scenario is going to be a little bit different. We didn't pack that bear out, for example, just because of the fact that that first night it was cold. Mm-hmm. And we were able to find that perfect spot where it just never got, even though the temps were in the 70s during the day, it never got probably above, you know, into the 60s. It was probably 40s and 50s most of the day in that shaded spot. And I felt totally comfortable doing that. And yeah. We'd check on it on occasion just to make sure everything was going good. And it was.
Well, I think too, like when you look at like that 40 to 50s, I guess, you know, average temp during the day, right? Plus that got, you know, chilled to the bone, probably below freezing at night. And when I've looked at the proper temperature just to age meat, like in mm-hmm. a meat locker, I think they say about 40 degrees. So
right.
You basically had that hanging in a meat locker.
You're basically just aging your meat there yeah. on the mountain for sure. Yeah. You're not losing anything. Yeah.
Have you ever, you know, you're talking about getting your meat into a creek bottom, which generally the air temps, you know, down there are cooler, you know, probably some shade, you got some vegetation, some trees down there in the creek bottom. Have you ever, or would you recommend cooling your meat in like a cold water stream or a cold high mountain lake? Let's say if you had a trash bag and were able to keep that dry, like, would you ever use yeah. that as like yep. a resource?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, for sure. It works. And for example, if somebody in your party forgets to bring cordage to hang their game meat, I won't name it, but
I could see like a specific situation like popping up in your head right there.
Yes. They forgot their cordage and they do have a couple of trash bags and you got a creek nearby. Absolutely. Had another example of that this year where we did just that. We had, now the choice in what you pick up for a trash bag is very important if you're going to do that. Mm-hmm. If you just buy your typical, I don't know what ply those things are. They're kind of a thinner black plastic. I don't know about you guys, but have you ever found one that doesn't leak? Because I sure haven't.
No,
things leak. Inevitably, you put something in there with blood, that blood's going to get in your pack. But what, you know, they have those hefty, like they're like a 45 or a 55 gallon contractor bag, and they're heavy duty bags.
Mm-hmm.
Those things have stood the test. Like they do not leak. And if you double up on those, sink your meat in a creek with those things doubled up, put rocks on it, carefully not to puncture any holes, obviously. That is a great way to go. I mean, it keeps it extremely cold as long as it stays dry. You just want to try to maintain that dry if possible. But no, it's a great way. And we've done it several times and had another example of that this year. And we sunk it in a creek and we had it sit there. And we'd go back and check on it again, just to make sure that it was staying dry and staying submerged in the creek. And obviously there's no sun hitting that black bag, which will cause, you know, whatever condensation in that bag.
Okay.
And,
right.
And it works works really well. So keep the sun off it and keep it submerged completely in a dry sack. And it's a really effective way to go.
So you want that water even running kind of, over the top of the meat that's in the bag as well, not just kind of like maybe cooled from mostly the bottom.
If you can. I know sometimes those mountain creeks are only so deep, but if you have to work with.
I didn't even think about the sun thing too, but yeah, if you have something that's cold and then sun starts shining on it and starts warming up, you're going to get that cold beer can effect and it's going to sweat a little
bit. You're going to have moisture coming out from the inside. Sure.
You know, we're talking about water here, and, you know, not all water is going to be in the creek. A lot of it comes from the sky, right? So what about a situation where maybe you have good temps to hang meat, but rain is either in the forecast or it could be maybe you have even days of rain ahead, you know? What are some things that you can do to hang your meat but also keep it dry? Do you carry anything with you, you know, a contractor bag? Maybe that'll do the trick. Or, you know, what are some things that a person can do there?
Yeah, I've dealt with that in the past, especially being from Washington State there hunting rosies. It's hard to find days or trips where you're not dealing with at least a couple few days of rain. Usually in those scenarios, though, I'm trying to get that animal out. If I got a bunch of days of rain coming in, you want it to get cool, but you don't want to put it in a trash bag and hang it, obviously, if possible. Now, I have tried to build little like shelters and tarps over it. Just kind of split one side of the game bag and just kind of, it's kind of like a poncho around your meat after it's got a little bit of a crust to it.
Mm-hmm.
But inevitably, you want to keep it cool and dry. And so I tend to try to get that animal out. If you can find a great canopy, and generally in Washington State, for example, we had thick trees. It's not always the case out here in Montana. Sometimes it's really hard to find a canopy of trees that's going to stay dry in a heavy rainstorm. But places like Washington, typically it's pretty easy to find an area that you can hang that under a canopy that is not allowing it to just get soaked to the bone with rain.
Kind of like a tree umbrella, if you will, for your meat.
The tree umbrella works great. I think using a trash bag, though, again, it's a little risky because you're basically covering that thing with a sheet of plastic and you're probably going to get moisture anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I just try to get it out if it's going to be exposed to, you know, a lot of dampness and rain.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I was thinking in my head when I said that, I was thinking probably more along the lines of, well, maybe you cut the bag in half and create like a tarp with it and then maybe, you know, put it over the meat or something like that.
Right.
You know, with your cordage that you remembered to bring.
Sure. Cordage is important too. I know one of the things I used to always do, and I don't know why, I always used to short myself on cordage because I was a weight weenie, I guess. But I think typically now I'm off with about 100 feet of paracord. I used to try to skimp with 50, and inevitably when you have 50, the only branches you're going to find to hang are going to be like you know, 20 feet in the air, and they're going to be really, really tough to get your elk up there with that amount of cordage. So yeah. I try to go big and at least pack about 100 feet of cordage these days to ensure, because I tell you, there's some places, especially around burns, that sometimes it's pretty difficult to find hanging trees. So you end up finding one branch and it's usually a little bit higher than you'd hoped.
Yeah.
How are you actually, so now I'm trying to picture this, and I think I saw this, you know, on that bear hunt that you were talking about earlier, but if you've got a high branch like that, and that's kind of what you have to hang your meat on, how are you getting it over to...
A little old-fashioned tree climbing?
Oh, just running that cordage, a little slip knot over a rock and chucking that rock over the branch, and then, you know, giving the old heave-ho. You know, hopefully, if you don't have a buddy, you know, you kind of have to hang, obviously, lighter bags. You may do individual bags. You know, typically on an elk hunt, for example, a lot of those bags are going to weigh, gosh, 40 pounds or so, and try to keep separation. So, you know, yeah, it's pretty easy with one guy just to get that rock up and over and then just heave it up there and try not to waste all your cordage.
The old slip knot over the rock routine, Jim.
Oh, classic.
A million times.
Now when you're hanging, you're hanging meat, and I know I've heard some people say that, you know, as you, and I've seen sometimes with aged meat, it can kind of start to look funny. Or when you're talking about that crust that forms, not people aren't always familiar with the crust. I don't actually even know what the crust is, the science behind it. It's just sort of something you just see happen. But there's times where you're looking at it and you're thinking to yourself, well, that doesn't look normal to me, especially if you're somebody who's just been getting your meat from a grocery store. You're just, well, that doesn't look like how it looks in the grocery store. What are the signs that it is good versus bad? I mean, is it pretty obvious when it is bad? Is it just smell that you're only going off of, or are there things that you can visually see that you're like, nope, that's bad, I'm not gonna eat that or try to whatever?
Yeah, I think it's the old sniff test, Jim. Obviously, I think it's gonna be your number one telltale. But hopefully it never comes to that. And yeah. I've been real fortunate to not lose meat over the years. I had one elk, gosh, probably 20 years ago. It was just an old gnarly bull. And that was like the one bull that I remember that the meat was just not very good. But since then, I've been really fortunate to just not lose meat. But, you know, if you leave a quarter intact, for example, and maybe it's not as cool as you'd hoped it was, usually what happens is that bacteria starts forming around the bone, and you'll get, especially around that ball socket, that's kind of the meatiest part of that hind quarter there. That's where they'll start to break down, and you'll kind of get a little bit of a smell around that. You might have to cut a little bit away from that. You know, if you haven't, for example, like I mentioned, opened that up and butterflied it out a little bit. A lot of times if you're not diligent, you don't have a really cold night to get that thing cooled to the bone, that's where you'll start to lose meat, is around that ball socket there.
Gotcha.
Okay. So meat shouldn't smell bad. That's the thing.
It should not smell bad. And that rind that you get when you hang it, for example, like some guys are really into dry aging meat when they get it back, right? And that's, it definitely does break the meat down and you get a tenderness to it. I don't do that a whole lot. Sometimes I will. I play with it on occasion. I'll just leave a hind quarter out and I'll break down the rest. And last year I had one, gosh, I must have had it hanging for 4 months. And I just keep breaking off of it. I live here in Montana though. It is, nothing rots here. It's just dry as can be. And I left, it was my last hunt of the year. It was in November, very dry environment in my garage. And I could go out there on occasion 3 months after and just take a nice choice cut, and it's extremely tender and it never went bad. Now it formed a pretty good crust around, obviously, that you would have to trim off.
Okay.
And so you lose a little, surprisingly not that much, but yeah, that rind is just something that you end up having to shave off. It's just a crust, air from the outside. It just kind of forms that, and it's not a bad thing. It's just you lose meat in the process of letting that form.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I just like the meat as is. I'm not necessarily going to dry age everything. If, you know, I'll play with it on occasion, but not always.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that rind or that crust is almost like, you know, picture you take a piece of meat, at least this is how I'm picturing it, because it's like, it gets dry. It's almost like a jerky, and you picture you're taking a piece of meat, and you put it in like an air dehydrator, which is kind of circulating air around it, and it almost kind of turns, it's almost like the same effect.
Like it is, like, it's a good word. It's just like jerky, Mark, you're right. And usually, you know, what I do with it is give it to the dogs. Like I put it in a bag, I put it in the freezer, and you just get those nice little jerky sized pieces, and the dogs love it. It doesn't hurt them.
I think I'm just going to start seasoning it. I'm just kidding. I don't think I'm going to do that.
If you're into that kind of thing, Marco.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But, meat can, where was we were talking about?
Well,
smell.
We're talking about smell. And so I think, you know, I've heard people describe that as bone sour, you know, kind of just like an off putting, sour, funky.
Oh, but I remember what I was going to ask. It doesn't necessarily mean that the whole thing is bad. So
this is
something where I know with my inexperience level, I get uncomfortable. I even in this way with some stuff that's just not wild game and stuff that I just have around the house, you know, where you get a spot on something, or, you know, you see something or you smell something, you're like, it looks kind of bad, but you can tell you can usually kind of tell, well, it's coming from that side of it or that section of it. And I never really know, does that mean the whole thing is? And usually when you're not really familiar, you're like, well, I don't feel like getting food poisoning over this or whatever. So I'm just going to kind of, that's the safe play. But it sounds like you can trim that out. And how do you know how much to trim out? Is there some sort of a visual cue as well to go along with the smell that you can be like, oh yeah, I've got all the bad stuff away?
Yeah, not too much of a visual, honestly. You know, there may be a little discoloration there if it's really bad, but it could look normal and have a little bit of a smell, like that sour smell, Mark, off the bone there. And it really is. It's you shave a little bit off and give it the sniff test again. But
all right. Hey, yeah.
Usually you don't definitely need to throw the whole thing out if you're able to trim away anything that has a little bit of a, you know, off smell to it.
That's good to know.
Yeah,
the old sniff test doesn't lie. And it's sometimes, like, as humans, we don't rely on our nose nearly as much as many other creatures out there do. So I'm always trying to rely on my eyes, you know.
Yeah,
and then
right.
So I just think to myself, well, I mean, yeah, it smells okay, but I just still can't fully put all my weight into that nose. Yeah,
it works for a gallon of milk too, Jim.
Yeah, just write bad on the jug and put it back in the fridge.
I don't know about you guys either, but if you're really concerned and, like, you don't have the best sniffer like I don't, bring your wife in or your girlfriend or whatever. They usually have a much better sniffer than we do. And my wife will tell me if it doesn't smell right, whatever food it is, not just meat. But
I think that's actually like a proven scientific thing, that women have a better sense of smell. Don't quote me, but I feel like I did read that, like, there's been studies done that they have better sniffers than I do. And I know that's the case at my house as well. My wife will be like, do you smell that? And I'm the answer is no. I feel like
my wife has a better sense of everything, because somehow I'm always making annoying sounds, I'm always smelling in a weird way, or I'm always, there's like things that there's things that she sees that she's like, I can't stand that, it doesn't bother me at all. So I just a little bit more acute senses.
You're constantly bugging her.
It sounds like. It seems like.
You and I are in the same boat, Jimmy. Sounds like my
place. Well, I'll grab the oars, because I'm right there with you.
All right. Same boat.
Getting back to breaking an animal down in the field, and hopefully you're doing everything and getting that meat cooled so we never even have to deal with this whole, you know, having the meat spoilage. But what do you prefer on a big game animal, Ryan? You know, a lot of folks are doing the gutless method. You know, some people still, or a lot of people still gut their big game animals. I know I kind of do both right now. It kind of depends on the situation. And sometimes it's, you know, temperature related, or just, you know, how close I am to home. I guess, what are you doing predominantly, or is it situational specific for you, how you're going to, you know, go through the process of getting that meat off the animal?
Man, good question. I think predominantly for me, because I do like to spend my time in the backcountry. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be different answers for everyone on this. I think when you're deep into the backcountry and you're just far away and you're not able to even think about getting the animal out whole, predominantly, I am doing the gutless method. In saying that, though, you do end up getting into the guts at one point if you like eating the heart, if you're a liver guy. I'm not, but I know a lot of people are into the liver. But for example, like I could never leave the heart in an animal. My daughter would not let me live that down. It's the first question she asks when I get home is where's the heart? Because that's what she wants first. It's her absolute favorite cut of meat. And so inevitably, even though you're doing the gutless method and you're breaking off those four quarters, you're getting both sides of the loin off, you're getting the neck meat off, you end up popping a rib and getting in there and ripping the heart out. And then you can get to the liver if you'd like. You know, for those guys that do like, you know, call fat, if you want to wrap call fat around a piece of meat, tenderloin or heart or whatever as well, you end up getting into the guts as well. So there really is no, it's kind of to each his own. Some guys aren't into the organ meat. Some guys don't mess with call fat at all. But for those that do, you're kind of getting in there no matter what. Mm-hmm. Now, it is extremely quick to just pull those quarters off, get them into shade, and work on an animal like that. And it's a little less messy if you're not dealing with organ meats at all. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of guys prefer to do it that way. And typically that's what I end up doing. So if I get an animal down by myself with a group, whatever, I'll tend to peel that hide back and I'll pull that quarter off. If I'm by myself, a lot of times what I'll do is if it's in the evening, it's not smack dab in the middle of a sunny patch. And if it's out in the middle of and it's getting full sun, I'll try to get that quarter off and get it to some shade. And then I'll either decide whether I'm going to pack the bone out or I'm going to break off each group of muscles off of that hiney and put it in the game bag. But, you know, I sometimes will, if I'm by myself, I'll just get those pieces broke off of there, get them into the shade, get them hung if I'm planning on getting it out that night. But, you know, that's kind of the, and then after you get all those two top quarters off, you get the strap, you can grab that tenderloin from that side, you can roll it, peel back the hide, pull the other quarters off, tenderloin back strap. And then what I'll do is I'll just get in there. I'll roll those ribs. You know, you can get a nice rib roll and pull that meat off. And then once you get that, it's pretty easy to just pop a rib and reach in there and grab the heart off there. Now, I'm not real good about taking the liver every time. My wife gives me grief, but I'm a huge hater of liver. I just don't like it. I know it's good for me. I should eat it more, but I typically, it just doesn't do me anything. Whereas I know it's nutrient rich, but, so I definitely get the heart though. So I'll just pop that rib, reach in there, grab that heart out and I'm good to go.
Describe, because I know the ribs, you know, obviously when you have the internal organs in there, yeah, I guess still in the body cavity, you know, and, you know, over time, you know, particularly maybe if it's a little bit warm, you know, the animal starts to bloat a little bit and wants to press up against, you know, the rib cage there. Maybe describe that process of that rib roll and how you're getting that rib meat.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's usually, you know, and that may be a reason why you might want to open it up and kind of let some of that out in the back after you've pulled the quarters off. Usually it goes down. Like once you've opened up that cavity to get your inner tenderloins out, you know, it's usually not dealing with too much pressure there. So you're able to take a slice down one of those, you know, rib bones, kind of peel that meat over, take your scalpel and just kind of run it along that next rib bone that you're going for. Mm-hmm. And you can really make a nice clean sheet of rib meat without packing the bone out. And man, okay. That is some really good stuff, especially on an elk. But yeah, it's just being careful as far as not puncturing anything. And, you know, the ribs are fairly easy to just rib roll right off of there and get a nice big clean sheet. So,
gotcha. Yeah, if you start seeing anything that's puffing up and looks like a water balloon, don't poke it.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
I know that's what we started noticing a little bit. You know, you'd kind of make a cut, and then that spot where you made a cut, pretty soon you'd start seeing something sort of like puffing up through there. And you just got to be real careful around that.
Yeah, you know, and that's something to remember too. As you're trying to maybe get to those tenderloins, you know, is to maybe use your hand and use a little hand pressure to push them away or yep. down and in, so you can kind of do some little bit of knife work if you need to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point, Mark. And getting those tenderloins out, yeah, like you do have to use one hand to kind of push back the organs. And then, you know, a lot of times those tenderloins, you don't have to do a whole lot of knife work. You can really kind of peel that off with your hands. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of cuts there to get the whole piece off there, but you do have to kind of adjust and keep those organs from kind of pushing up against where you're using that blade. As well as, say, like if you're quartering an animal and everybody knows kind of when you take those hindquarters off, you know, you get everything on the outside cut and you're starting to break that hindquarter off of the socket there. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of people will make a mistake and they'll kind of get a little hasty and they'll get into the guts a little bit, you know, or the bladder or whatever, and they'll cause some wastage there. So mm-hmm. it's just being really diligent, working really slow in those areas where you may be cutting close to, you know, the stomach area or that bladder. So the last thing you want to do is get that stuff on your meat. You're just going to have to cut that off, or you're going to have a really foul flavor when you get it back.
So you bring up getting stuff on the good meat that you want to get out of there. So there's, I mean, I'm thinking of stuff that you can get on is obviously gut stuff. I don't know. Yeah. Juices and things. Then there's bloodshot meat as well, which bloodshot stuff is always kind of puzzled me because I'm like, well, there's blood everywhere in the thing, and how is it that then wouldn't you anyway? But then there's also dirt and all the other stuff too that's in the environment around the animal. As you're cleaning it and getting everything off, you know, you might get dirt mm-hmm. on it. So one, I'm wondering, what can you just clean off and how do you clean it off? So like if you get a little bit of dirt on something on accident, you know, is it best to brush it off? Do you, some people, you know, maybe rinse it off? What's the best thing to do there? And then two, what is it that you see when you're on, it gets on the meat, you're like, yeah, don't even try with that. Just trim that off. Or
yeah. What are the environmental enemies of the meat?
Right.
Definitely want to try to keep it clean. If you get too aggressive and you're breaking it down and you're cutting the hide the wrong way and you're cutting hairs and they're kind of getting all over your meat, it's just going to be a whole lot more cleaning that you have to do at the table at home. You know, a couple of those pieces that you're going to definitely want to trim off while you're in the field, you don't want any of, if you puncture a bladder, you know, a lot of most places you have to keep evidence of sex on your animal. So, you know, you're making sure that you're cutting around and you're getting that tallywhacker, whatever you want to call it, on one piece of the hindquarter. And you just want to be careful that you don't nick that bladder, because that bladder will just leach out some pretty nasty stuff. And I would immediately, if you ever do that, I would immediately just cut that away, get that off of there, wash your knife, because you're going to really taint that meat pretty bad. Okay. And, that's going to be probably coming in contact with your other game bags. It's going to be putting off smell, even in your cooler. I would just as soon cut that off right away versus, you know, if you get some hair and you get some dirt and you're in a hurry, those are things that you can deal with back home on the table. If you break down your own meat, you know, as careful as you want to be and as clean as you want it to be, sometimes you're in an environment, an old burn, and there's dust, and it's really difficult to be 100% clean. And there's, you're in grizz country or something like that, and you have to just kind of go a little faster than you'd like. That's just something that I'll deal with back home. And I'll just put the time in back there at the sink, and I'm rinsing that dirt off. No need to cut it off. Usually it comes away with a rinse. And if you've left that silver skin on for the most part, those are a lot of those pieces you end up trimming off anyway. Mm-hmm. And it just comes off with the trim. So it's not really getting to the actual steaky part of the meat where you're going to have it, you know, in your meal.
Yeah.
So,
yep. And you don't rinse
out. Most important, anything gut, intestine, juices, like you said, Jimmy, I definitely just trim that ASAP.
And you don't rinse out in the field, because then you get your meat wet when you don't necessarily have a fridge or a freezer right next to you.
Yeah. I don't do any rinsing back there at all. I just, one of the things I think more people are getting into working on their own meat back home. Mm-hmm. Great butchers and that do great work out there, but it's kind of fun. It's kind of a passion to get back home, and it's a fun day to just get all the cuts that you want broke down, vacuum packed, labeled, all that. It's whether you're making different sausages or pepperonis or grinds or burgers, whatever. You just take the day and you do that. And then you can be the judge of, well, you know, you're making sure there's not a hair in there, no dirt whatsoever. If you really want to get all the silver skin, fascia, all that stuff off of it, you can trim it and make sure it's off of it. You know, as far as fat as well, one thing, if you're doing your own meat, when it comes to deer and elk, you really want to trim a lot of that fat off. All game animals, even bear meat, it will go rancid on you in the freezer. And unless you render it down, and then it'll stay forever. But you do really want to get a lot of that trim off there. If you're planning on holding that animal for 6 months, 9 months, a year, you want to get that thing trimmed up. Silver skin isn't that important unless it's just not something that you want to chew on later. My wife's pretty particular about like tendons or silver skin or anything like that. So I have to do a little extra trimming on hers to make sure that she's not eating that stuff. But it doesn't bother me that much, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know I've seen, you know, getting back to, rinsing the meat, and I've seen guys do this when they have, you know, access to, you know, water at home, whether it's a hose or a bucket of water or something like that. And I guess I haven't done it myself, but I saw once a guy, he hid an animal too far back with a rifle, you know, got into the stomach, and there was just, you know, tons of stomach matter, you know, in the cavity of the animal. And so he rinsed it with a bucket, which in my head, it's like, it might visually look like that's rinsed out, but I think, at least from what I've heard, that can actually spread a lot of contaminants throughout and expose meat that otherwise wouldn't have had those contaminants on it. And now they are. I mean, have you heard the same thing, Ryan?
Yeah. I don't know that you're just going to rinse off all that bacteria and the insides of stomach contents and the acidity of whatever's in there. I would just assume cut it out and get it off that animal completely. I think if you do rinse it, it's probably something that could spread to good parts of the meat as well. And you're not going to thoroughly get rid of it. Yeah. But, I think just making sure you're really careful. You know, one of the things that if you do hit an animal a little far back and you get the gut shot, you know, that rib meat can have a little bit of an odor to it on the inside, which that may be something that you want to take into consideration if you've made a less than perfect hit on that animal. But one of the things that you want to know is each state is different as well. Some states require you take ribs, all four quarters, neck meat, everything. Some are all four quarters and, you know, tenderloins and whatever. But rather than pack out a little bit, like a couple of rib slivers that have been tainted with gut shot, I would just assume not pack that out and have it even come close to touching any of the other good clean meat, honestly.
Makes yeah, sense. You're kind of sacrificing the a ton of all your really primary great meat to save, you know, a little bit of stuff that really is just going to contaminate all your good stuff. So
right,
yeah. And Jimmy, you mentioned before, like the shot, like the blood shot.
Yeah,
yeah. So I was curious about that for a long time too. Like, is it really bad? Because, you know, it's just bruising is what it is, right?
Okay.
But there's blood kind of caught up in there. And I did find that there is kind of an off taste because there's that bruising, there's extra blood in that area.
Okay.
And so that's why it's almost better to just cut that bloodshot area off and really not deal with it. You know, sure. It usually has this gelatinous jelly that comes over that spot as well if you punched it in the shoulder.
Yeah, I always thought that was a weird one because people would open it up and they'd be like, oh, that's bloodshot. And I'm thinking to myself, well, of course there's blood. We just, you know, you shot it. And isn't there blood throughout the whole animal? I mean, there's not just blood in that part of it. But
it's bruising, yeah.
That makes sense now. But I mean, when you look at it, you kind of are like, oh, you know, and you think, cut that out, and then it looks fine.
Yeah.
But I just never understood, like, the science behind it, but it makes sense.
I think one thing, too, like you said, you got kind of like that extreme, you know, bruising. The meat is kind of almost that dark burgundy red with that blood in there, and you talk about, like, that clear gelatinous kind of goo that forms over there. But one thing that surprised me a couple times is you're like, oh my gosh, this, you know, this entire area is just like gone. We're going to lose it. But as you maybe take some of that off and kind of work your way in, it might not be as bad as you think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially if you punch it in the shoulder, you know, a lot of times, yeah, maybe you'll lose either the outside or the inside of that scapula there. If it, sometimes it's the outside, you get that jelly type, whatever, just, you know, maybe you lose a little there, but there's usually going to be pieces amongst that. That's good. You know, getting that fillet off the inside of the shoulder, maybe you'll save that, but just trimming off whatever is good for sure. Usually it's not a total loss, but you do lose a significant amount.
Yeah. Right. Right. I do think just all this stuff is really important to keep in mind. One thing that I guess I've wondered sometimes is it seems like, and I don't know if this is one of those urban legend tall tale kind of things or if it really is true, but it seems like some people label different animals as having different rates of spoil, if you will. And so Mark mentioned antelope earlier, and some people say, oh, an antelope, you got to be immediate with those things because they'll go bad a lot quicker than deer, elk, whatever. You know, and you got folks around here in Wisconsin who shoot a deer in the fall and they'll chuck the whole thing in the back of the truck, drive around with it for a while, and then they end up cutting it up later. And then it ends up being, I know some people end up then complaining about gamey flavor, but that's a whole nother thing. Is that an actual thing that you found where, oh boy, I shot this kind of animal, I got to get it out in game bags, dry, cooled down quicker than others?
Yeah. And yeah, you're right. The antelope thing has always been just that, right? You got to get that thing on ice as soon as possible. Now, I don't know where that comes from. You know, antelope meat is fantastic. It's some of the best.
Yeah.
As well as bear meat. Bear meat is some of the best. But those two critters, for whatever reason, have gotten that. Like, you, to get it right, you have to get that out and on ice as soon as possible. I think that goes with all of them for the most part. But I know with bear, you know, bear will turn on you with heat quicker. I think it's just the nature that it's fattier. And it's got a lot more fat like built into the meat. It's a greasy meat for sure. But, you know, getting it cooled down right away is just that much more important, I think, on bear. Now, antelope is a mystery to me. I don't know why that is. I don't know why it's so much more, or why it would be more important with an antelope versus a deer.
Yeah.
I feel like you just treat them all the same and really just try to get them cool and you know, in your ice box as quick as possible if you can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've heard that with now I'm not like an expert on antelope. Haven't done a ton of it, but I know the latest antelope I shot, it was fantastic, incredible meat. But I've also heard people say, oh, it's just not that good.
Right.
With all animals. I've heard that with bear and mule deer and things like that as well. But I think number one is if you are careful about keeping the contaminants off of it, you cool it down out of the gates. I don't care what animal it is. I feel like it's going to be pretty good.
Right.
Even an old sage buck, I feel like you can, you know, make that into really good table fare.
Yeah.
So
I mentioned the gamey flavor that some people will complain about. You got, whether it's somebody who's never tried wild game before and then, you know, or maybe they've tried it once before and they're talking to you and they're like, ah, I tried wild game once a long time ago. I just didn't really like it. And I know I've heard that around here a fair amount of times. Is gamey flavor, when people get that, is that like, oh, I could pick out exactly why it is that it tasted gamey, and it's because you waited too long to get it cool, and so this happened to the meat. Like, there's more bacteria on it, or is it just sort of, is gaminess a phrase that gets thrown out anytime you're like, well, it was kind of dirty, or well, it had some kind of gut contaminants on it, or it was a little bit bloodshot, or it was a little bit, anytime it just
tastes
off.
Or you overcooked it.
Right, yeah, anytime it just tastes off, is that what gaminess is, or is it actual like a, oh no, one specific characteristic about wild game that creates this gaminess?
Boy, you know, I think it's a combination of things. Now, there's probably different varying opinions on this, but my opinion is how it's prepared, maybe it's the butcher you use. There's better and there's really good butchers and there's not so great that don't take the time to clean it up, maybe get all that extra fat off. If you don't get like venison fat, elk fat trimmed off completely, it will turn on you. And, you know, if they're pulling out a package of mule deer meat that's been in there for 6-8 months and there was a little bit of untrimmed fat or whatever on that meat, it's probably not going to be very tasty. It's going to have a gaminess to it. I know I've experimented with trying to eat, like trying to make burger out of like venison fat back in the day. I hated the fact that I was trimming all of it off when I kind of liked the fat and I was adding fat later to the burger anyway, but it definitely has a gamey, not so great taste versus like a beef fat or a pork fat.
Right.
It's just different.
Right.
It's just way different. Bear fat is different again than say like elk fat or deer fat. Elk and deer, it's just an antelope as well. It's just not a fat that you want to have on your meat. You want to take the extra time to make sure it's all trimmed off. But I think it's a combination of that, Jim, as well as, not getting it cooled down quick enough. I think a lot of people, I see folks driving around with, the animal in the back of the pickup, maybe on a big old 6-8 hour drive back home, and it's just sitting in the bed of the pickup, the bed liner, there's road heat, it's got the hide on, things like that. I don't know. I just don't feel like you're going to have the most highest quality of game meat at the end of that travel. So I think it's at the table where you're trimming it as well as getting the thing cooled off. You just don't want that thing to be in a higher temp than it has to be for any period of time.
Yeah. And a lot of people cook up that meat that, you know, was in the back of the truck for 6-8 hours or something. They cook it up and they don't get food poisoning from it. But you can tell it just doesn't taste good. So that's where there's, you know, it's kind of interesting how there's a difference there somewhat in just food safe, you know, like technically it can enter your body and not harm you, but then there's also the taste aspect of it.
Yeah, you want to enjoy it.
Right.
Well, you know, and keeping that in mind, and that's something I wanted to bring up. So what does your, what's your, I guess, system look like? You know, maybe it's a warm weather hunt or just any hunt. You've killed something in the backcountry. You know, maybe you might be making multiple trips back to your pickup, you know. What's your, maybe your cooler system look like? You know, how much ice do you have in that cooler? And, you know, so you're getting that meat cooled off, you know, I guess, you know, as quickly as possible during that process.
Yeah, and it differs every time. I know, like for example, I keep bringing up Nevada, but Nevada's just got the extreme conditions down there.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I go down to a place like that and it's going to be hot and there's going to be a distance between when I get back to that trailhead and to when I can get to a store that maybe has dry ice or some blocked ice or whatever, I am going to pre-plan my trip. And I have these little 1 gallon, it's like a mini 5 gallon bucket. And, you know, I've got those frozen and layering the bottom of my large coolers. And you can also, you know, have those froze up before you go, layer the bottom of your coolers. That does two things. When you have that, it also keeps the meat up off of the bottom and it's where it's just sitting in its own blood. Mm-hmm. But, and then hopefully once you get back to your trailhead, you can toss that meat in, feel good about it. Your cooler is pre-chilled. So maybe if you have 5-6 hours bouncing down a gravel road and you got to get to the closest town before you can get to that ice, you're worry free. One thing I do like to do is if available, I'll find some dry ice if I still got a long drive home. Now I don't put that dry ice on top of the meat. It will freeze it. Anything underneath that dry ice is going to get frozen, but I will use that to either refreeze or kind of layer the bottom of my cooler on top of those buckets of frozen ice water. It just blocks them right back up if they've had any thaw to them. And that just keeps that cooler nice and chilled and dry versus just throwing a bunch of crushed ice in there. If that's all you have and you're just going to throw a bunch of crushed ice on top of the meat, make sure you, again, use one of those contractor bags that doesn't leak. And then you don't have to worry about all that moisture. It's pretty important. So
I know
back in the day it was get that meat in the cooler, throw a bunch of crushed ice on it, and then what did you have? You had like a blood soup at the bottom of your cooler. Your meat is going to be just, you know, soaking in that for that ride home. And it's just not the best way to go.
Just kind of gets wet and soggy a little bit. And yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I've gotten asked that question a lot, is how do you keep it, the meat off the bottom of your cooler, where, you know, if blood is going to inevitably kind of drip down in there. One thing you can do is just save up your whatever water bottle is you use, Aquafinas or whatever, and you just toss those in the bottom of that cooler, and it just kind of gets a little barrier there. Sure. Just enough to keep it off of the blood. It's cheap, it's easy, effective.
And yeah, you can, that makes sense.
You can freeze those up with frozen water too before you go, and they kind of act as a twofer there.
Yeah, it's kind of like a layer of ice, and also like elevates it, but has enough, I guess, gap between them that whatever,
yeah,
blood and whatever just kind of goes down and stays in the bottom of the cooler.
Mark, you should bring up your idea, your science experiment.
I don't
Unless
know if
you
it's
don't want to expose
I'll bring it
to the world yet.
I'll bring it up. I want to. Well, I'll,
why don't we?
We'll talk
why
about,
we
we'll talk about it at the.
There's a lot of smart people
I've got
who listen
more questions.
To this podcast. Well, all right.
Okay. This goes in with this. So I was thinking
the
other day.
Suggestions. Ryan may have some suggestions.
And I don't know if this is a good idea or not. But I was looking at, I guess, the properties of water and salt water, and I was like, okay, well, when you create or when you combine, I think the proper ratio was a half cup of like regular salt with a pound of ice, and it creates kind of like this salt water ice slurry where it actually melts the ice, but I think it lowers the freezing point to where it's actually 0 degrees versus 32 degrees.
Okay. Yep.
And then I was thinking, okay, well, if you made this slurry and put it in your cooler, and you had these contractor bags that you're talking about, if you took your, it would keep your cooler really cold, so pre-chilled, and you could put like your quarters or your boned out meat in those contractor bags and kind of submerse it, kind of creek style, like we were talking about earlier, but in your cooler. But then I also think 0 degrees, like that's really froze, that might freeze your meat, which may or may not be a bad thing. Ryan Lampers, your thoughts?
Oh boy. Without trying it, it sounds great, Mark. I
like that's where I'm at.
Yeah, it sounds good to me. I think no, it'd be interesting. I don't know. I'd have to look at that ratio, how you make that slurry. You said a half a cup of salt, and
I think it was a half a cup of salt to essentially a per pound of crushed ice. Was that it? Don't okay. quote me, but
something
I was.
Like that. It's the most scientific thing I've ever heard you like look into.
It's because it had to do with like preserving game meat. That's
right,
why I
hunting.
Cared.
Right, just hunting.
You're gonna have to get somebody on much smarter than I to determine whether that's effective.
We're gonna some comments. We need to, yeah.
comments from the
if
listeners.
You're a scientist, please let us know if we're insane. A couple questions. This is more of kind of like a gear process related question. So we've got
this will be our light at the end of the tunnel section here. A couple questions.
Oh boy, I've got to actually. Okay, this might be a longie. Ryan, you might have to edit out any sort of gaps that we have in here. So I'm kind of backtracking here. I'm kind of backtracking because you know we got to get in the meat in the cooler. But let's say you've gotten an elk down in the backcountry. I know for me that is not one trip. If it is one trip for anybody out there, my hat is off to you, but what kind of backpack style do you like? Do you like a pack that has like a meat shelf? Are you putting your meat in the pack? And then also along with that, are you keeping, you know, throwing in your pickup, like a pack frame? It's like, okay, now I've got my first load out. I'm putting the pack frame on and I'm going back in for the rest of it. What's your kit look like in that regard?
I don't have a pack frame. I carry a little bit larger pack than maybe the average guy. I run a 7,900 cubic inch pack.
Okay.
Because a lot of these trips have turned into 10 to 12 day trips. Whew. And so food adds up and takes up space. And so I, what I used to get away with was around a 5,000 cubic, 5,500 for a week stay. Now I tend to 2 pounds of food. It ends up being a lot of bulk, a lot of weight. So I run a 7,900. It's a Stone Glacier pack that I found that just fits my need for those longer extended stays. The meat shelf, I don't probably use it as much as a lot of folks do, backcountry guys. I know a lot of people it's just the cat's meow. I mean, you put your meat in the meat shelf, you keep your camp up front in your bag, and that's the way to go. honestly, I'll do it both ways. It's kind of situational. You know, if, for example, I'm by myself and I've got the time, I want to try to one trip a deer out because I don't want to have to go back in. If it's 10 miles in, I would just as soon go slow and easy, get that entire animal on my back. Now, depending on how much stuff I've got, if I've got a lot of food left, if I'm down to my 10th day and I got no food left, typically I can honestly get that entire deer inside my pack with my camp gear on top. Mm-hmm. Now I'll kind of stage that a little bit differently. I usually like to get most of the meat to the middle of my pack. I don't like it on the bottom. I'll put some of the softer sleeping bag, even type stuff on the bottom, and then get a lot of that heft and weight to the middle of my back. It just rides better for me. But yeah, the meat shelf, if you're early in a trip, you got a lot of food, you got a lot of gear, it's kind of nice to have that meat shelf. Now, another big advantage to the meat shelf is you're not having to put that animal in a hefty trash bag.
Yep.
If you put your game meat, even though it's been hanging for a night or two, inevitably, if you put just the straight game bag in your backpack, in the bag part of the pack, you're going to have blood. You're going to have kind of a mess on the bottom of your pack. And so you end up putting it in one of those, again, those hefty trash bags that doesn't leak. I can't stress enough, get the right bags, because it will leak if it's just your classic 33-gallon thin-walled trash bag. But if you want the air to be exposed, if you got a long pack out, you know, it's typically better to not get it in a game bag or in a trash bag. And it's a little bit more exposed to the air if it's just in a game bag and it's on your meat shelf. Mm-hmm. And another reason, if I want to pack the bones out of the mountain, say on a mule deer, my wife wants some bone broth, she wants to cut up some, get the marrow. Typically, I'll use the meat shelf for that, because those entire hindquarters with the femur and everything attached in the shank, they don't fit into your pack very right. well. So it's better to just run it off the meat shelf, and those legs will be sticking up a little bit. So I'd say each scenario is a little bit different, especially with elk too. If you're making trips and you're packing an elk out and you're in grizz country, you don't really want blood all over. I always tend to put that into a hefty bag, and then I try to put it inside my pack and try to get it out. I just don't want to have to go back in with, you know, a bloody pack. And that's the other thing that I didn't mention, is if you're just running those game bags on your meat shelf, you still are going to have blood kind of dripping down and getting on the bottom of your pack. I just wouldn't advise doing that if you're in grizz country and you have multiple trips and you have to go back in several times. You're just leaving like there's blood in the water for sharks. They're just land sharks back there. So
makes
less blood, the better.
You know, and I know I was talking to you one time about this, Ryan, and it actually made sense. But if you were saying, and so definitely, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you had your meat and it was nice and chilled, having it in your pack with some things around it can actually help keep it cool, kind of insulate
it. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. It sure does. Say you got to get some sleep and you're going to pack out the next morning. You know, you got that thing hanging all night and it's cool. You got a long, hot day ahead of you. And you got to get out that day and you're not going to do the night hike, which I would suggest, but you got a long hot day. You're right, Mark. If you got a mule deer, a couple of hindquarters on there, and you get it inside the bag, you know, you can open up your sleeping bag out of the stuff sack and pack that around the entire thing. And it's just insulation. And you'll be surprised, I mean, how cool that will keep your meat. It's basically just like in a cooler when you have a sleeping bag and your puffy jacket or pants or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, surrounding that meat as well, as it is just like a, you know, a thermal blanket. So definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, there's so many different variables involved. It's like we keep saying, every situation is a little bit different time of day when you're packing out, but I mean, this is all super good information. You ever have problems with flies, have to combat flies or do anything specific to keep insects off your meat?
Yeah. You know, I haven't for the longest time. I know I used to when I ran like those cheesecloth style game bags.
Okay, right.
those things are terrible. I mean, the bees can get in there. The flies can get in there and, you know, put blow on your meat and all mm-hmm. that. And it's just bad news. Now, obviously, we've come a long way. We've got these really nice, lightweight, tight-stitched synthetic game bags now. No issues with flies whatsoever. Now, there is a little bit, say you're breaking down an animal and you already got a bunch of yellow jackets and you got flies. Usually what I like to do is once I get that animal broke down is I like to kind of get that meat immediately into some shade outside of a game bag and just like, you know, starting to cool before you put it even into just a synthetic game bag.
Okay.
But the only thing that changes is if you have flies. Now there's just certain times of the year, certain areas that you don't have them. There's times of the year and places that you will, and then you'll just need to get it right into a game bag and just try to keep it cool. But it cools definitely a lot faster if you are able to lay it on a rock, hang it somewhere before you get even the rest of the animal broke down. I'm trying to get those pieces laid out and starting to cool right away. But the only thing that hinders you from doing that is flies. You know, you got to put a game bag around it and just keep them off of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know back in the day when guys would like to hang it, I think citric acid, they would put a little citric acid powder. They'd put a little bottle, spray it down, spray the meat down with the citric acid, kind of keeps the flies off of it. I would just rather put it in a game bag, something that's not going to allow those little critters in there. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. When you're butcher, do you wear gloves when you butcher, or do you take any maybe special precautions when you're maybe butchering a bear or something like that where trichinosis might be present?
I don't use gloves. There was a time that I did. This felt like extra garbage I ended up having in my pack in the end. But no, I don't wear gloves, honestly. There's probably good reasons why people would. I mean, to get trichinosis, you do have to ingest. I've talked to people about that. Like, what was the worry about just getting blood from a bear in a cut, for example? And I don't think there's any threat of trichinosis.
Okay, gotcha. Way. Which I didn't know that either. I guess I didn't know either way. And I generally cut myself at least once when I'm, processing an animal.
Got to be ingested. So yeah, cause that was a big worry. Like even the knife that you use after you've broke down a bear, is that a knife that you can use before you thoroughly washed it? And everything that I've read and learned is that no, it's not a way to get trichinosis. It's going to be ingesting of meat, not blood.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's good to know. Cause I've always wondered like, okay, let's say you're processing a bear and maybe you didn't use gloves or you didn't have them and you're not able to like maybe super thoroughly wash your hands. You don't have a million wipes. There's not a creek nearby. And now you're like, yeah, I want to eat this food that I packed, but I've got, bloody bear hands. You know, am I going to pop the old trichinosis in there? So it sounds like probably not.
And I'm the worst. The dirty hands and all that just doesn't bother me back there. We joke about it all the time because it gets, especially after you've broke down an animal. I mean, I'm eating snacks right after I'm breaking down an animal with bloody hands. I don't know. My wife, I think at one point told me it's good for your gut biome to eat a lot of dirt and grossness. So I'm going to use that. And that's what I'm going to go with. So,
all about that gut biome.
Yeah.
Big gut biome guy.
I'm going to jump back real quick. I know I've got a million questions here, but I think they're all good questions, Jim. So,
Mark, you don't have to explain it.
Well, I feel like, we're running long and Ryan needs to go shoot a giant elk. And,
you're getting a little sweaty.
I'm not sweaty. We're talking a little bit earlier about keeping blood off your pack, like, probably try and do it at all costs, safety and grizz country. But I know I've had a few things, whether it's like even just like a shirt sleeve that you get, you kind of accidentally get that in a bunch of blood and a couple of days later, I mean, it's just as ripe as can be, other than just washing it with a bunch of soap, a pack, which is maybe kind of can be more difficult to wash. How are you keeping that from getting rotten? Or if you do get blood on it, are you doing anything special to clean it up
during the trip or after the trip?
That'd be an after the trip thing.
Yeah. After the trip, I'll give it a wash. If I've got blood on it, definitely bring it back. A couple easy ways. I mean, you can just, if you're out of state or whatever, and you're traveling, you can just take it to the car wash and kind of pressure spray it down.
Yeah.
Soap it up a little bit and then pressure wash it from a distance. Try not to rip all those seams off. But then, yeah, you can get it back and you can run that bag through the wash or, toss it, pull the bag off of the frame, if the frame's got blood, just leave it on the frame and put it in a tub and soap it up and then and really rinse it well.
Okay.
But it will get really rank on you.
Yep.
If you don't take the time after a trip where it's been, you know, exposed to blood, you're going to have a stinky, pity the guy that's walking behind you on that next hike in, because it's going to be nasty. So
yeah,
definitely important to keep that pack clean.
Rotten.
Rotten
blood is not a good smell.
Well, no, we're talking about this bad. As I have a pack with some blood on it in my house right now.
It's not very little, very little. Getting back and not getting back, and this might be actually my last question. So, but I think it'd probably be one that a lot of folks would be curious about because everybody loves gear. I guess what knives and style of knives or even saws are going in your pack? You know, let's say it is probably, we'll go with a backcountry hunt because that seems to kind of like automatically pare your kit down to the essentials that are going to work the best. So what's in your backcountry kill kit as far as, you know, from a knife perspective, or maybe even some of the other things that you carry?
Yeah, let me think. So my kill kit doesn't have many things in it. It's got 9 game bags. I found a small company over in your guys' neck of the woods, Graxaw. It makes these really nice, lightweight synthetic game bags. Extremely lightweight. Each one carries about 40 pounds. So I carry 9. It's a little bit extra, but sometimes I'll use that extra for the skull to keep flies off of the skull head. So it works out about right with those 9 game bags. What else is in the kit is 100 feet of paracord, you know, for elk hunts and stuff like that as well. My tags stay in there. And I, as far as knives go, Mark, I've got 2 knives that I run. I do carry a replaceable blade, and then I carry a fixed blade. That little combo, and I used to take way more knives than I probably needed to. And over time, the more trips you spent in the backcountry, you always trim your entire gear list down to things that you're only going to use. Well, so as far as those knives go, yeah, I carry a fixed blade, which I always carry around my neck. It's actually always around my neck, and it's this right here.
Well, that was pretty freaking
it's just,
cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's a great little knife. Actually, it's a new blade that just came out. A hunter created it. Travis Nowotny made it. It's called Goat Knives.
Okay.
And boy, they've got some really nice stuff. I've ran Benchmades for a lot of years, and they're great. And they've got a really nice hard steel, that SV90 that you can get it tackied up before your hunt. And no worries, you know, you're going to break down an animal or two before you have to sticky it back up. This particular knife I just got, it's got a Nitro V steel to it. I mean, I've gone through 2 elk so far, and I think I could still shave the hair on my arms. It's so dang sharp. I've got a really good bevel on that thing. But yeah, those replaceable blades, I'll take, you know, it's basically, well, it's like the actual knife itself. And then I'll take, generally I have 4 replaceable blades in my kill kit. That always covers it. I think they make the blades a little bit tougher than they used to. Maybe I was just cutting wrong back in the day when like the first Havilons came out, but I used to kind of break those blades pretty frequently when breaking down a animal. Maybe it's just figuring out how not to bend those blades or tweak them, because I don't seem to break any anymore. And you know, one blade will get you through an animal with a combination of, say, a fixed blade for, you know, knuckling off those lower legs and, you know, all that, and then getting the head off and such. So really just that combination is going to get you through a hunt. No sweat.
Awesome. Well, that makes me feel good, because that's basically identical to my kill kit. So that's kind of what I've gone to, is I carry 1 super lightweight replaceable and then a good fixed blade. I've got a Benchmade that I really like, and then I've got a really nice knife from Argali. I like that knife too. That's what we did those antelope with the other day. And then game bags and some rope. I guess I got to start carrying 100 feet of cordage though. I've been going with the 50, but
inadequate.
Just trust me, when you're on an elk hunt and you're limited on cordage and you're trying to double or triple game bags up a tree, maybe by yourself, even with a couple guys, that can be a real struggle. And if you can't do it, sometimes that means you're going to have to haul that out that night. So I think having a little bit of extra weight and going big on the cordage is never a bad thing. And if you're in G-Bear country, even just Black Bear country as well, typically you're going to need maybe 30 feet anyway to hang your food every night. So a little extra cordage is one thing that I would definitely advise people or recommend people take with them, especially if you're on an elk hunt out west.
Yep. Well, and you know, it's not just for hanging meat, particularly like you said, if you're by yourself, if you got an extra set of hands to hold a leg, or, you know, maybe you got an animal that's in a somewhat precarious spot, sometimes you need to, you know, lash it off to something, or, you know, you can hold that leg back so it's not, you know, flopping down and hitting you in the head while you're trying to work, or you can, you know, apply some needed tension, you know, to pull it away so you can keep cutting. So that rope comes in pretty handy in a variety of ways.
Ryan, you have no idea what you've just done, though, is that you just suggested Mark to take more things into the field. And so now
I'm better, Jim.
Are you? You've just added yet another 50.
Very little. I've taken a lot away.
I've yet to see that.
Jim, you got to understand, though, like if I'm going like into a mountain, then I can pare things down, you know, pretty darn good. Like, actually really good.
I would love to see it.
I love taking less. Jim, I just wore the same pair of socks for 4 days straight. Didn't take them off.
I know. That was disgusting. Of all the things you brought, an extra pair of socks was not one of them.
I brought two pairs of socks for the trip.
A vacuum sealer with no bags and a giant box full of knives that we never used was two of them.
I brought two pairs of socks, and I was saving that second set for the back end of the hunt so I could ride home in comfort.
Just put your Crocs on. Regardless, that you also took.
You give me a full vehicle, I might fill it. You know, because then you're like, oh, what if we want to go trout fishing? Or, you know what, tuck the old shotgun in.
That's why I picked a Subaru. Mark,
you should probably not get a 7,900 cubic inch pack, Mark, because you'll probably try to fill it. You don't want to fill that thing.
I won't. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Like I said, though, I mean, I can pare it down if I'm going to be away from the comforts of a vehicle or something like that. But, you know, you leave your options open if you bring extra stuff on a trip. What if the hunting is horrible, but the trout fishing could be great, Jim? Actually, I'm still just going to keep hunting.
Extra pair of socks, though. Wow, that's novelty back there. Extra pair of socks.
See? Listen. So you're going in 12-day hunt, Ryan. You know,
how many socks
I'll say
you got on a 12-day
let's
hunt,
go from Ryan. A 5 to 12-day hunt. How many pairs of socks are you bringing?
Same pair. One pair.
See?
That's it.
I just can't buy it.
you're talking to me about bringing extra stuff.
A lot of people in World War I lost feet that way.
Yeah.
That's my thought.
I think that's specific to each person because I am very, very lucky and fortunate to have feet that don't get blisters. They don't get hot spots. I can't get a blister to save my life. And so I think if for folks that like sweat a lot more, maybe you lose a lot of salt and you get like, I've had buddies, I mean, their socks are like stiff as a board and they got like salt stains on them. And if you're that guy, I'd probably say bring more socks. I'm just really lucky. I don't sweat through my feet. I've got a hunting partner that I think he leaks buckets through his feet when he's hiking. Mm. And so
that's me.
I just don't have that.
We've completely derailed. We had a nice little capper offer here. I think we'll just cut the end of this thing off.
If there's any way I can just
poke the bear
over here. That's
Ryan, thank you so much, though, man.
Yes,
wealth of information, and I think anybody listening to this is going to get a ton out of it as far as, you know, taking that animal from the mountain and getting it back home, you know, for processing, whether they do that at that home or at their house or if they take it somewhere. They got a lot of great tips to make sure that meat's going to be the best that it can be. So thank you so much. And now, hopefully, you can get the heck out of here and put these things into practice.
By all means.
I tell you, like I was telling you guys, I found a bull here in the great state, and man, he's a slippery one. I've only seen him once, but that's where I'm heading right now. After we talk, I'm going to jet out of here and go pack in and try to relocate that bull. He's just a unbelievable dream bull, surrounded by a bunch of good bulls, but we need a little weather to keep those guys out in the open. It's spot and stock time, so hoping they stay out in the open a little bit longer with some cooler weather and can get in there and get an arrow in that thing.
Heck yeah,
that's where I'm headed.
All right, and everybody out there, go check out Hunt Harvest Health too, another great podcast. And if you have any questions about this stuff, hit up old Ryan Lampers here and his crew. He's got Doc Hillary over there as well. They know a lot of stuff. So But thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll catch you on the next one. And thanks for tuning in to 150 full-length episodes. All right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
All right, that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Vortex Nation podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Hit that subscribe button so you can always stay up to date on the latest happenings over here at the Vortex Nation podcast. Leave us a review or comment down below. We want to hear what you have to say about the show, maybe what you like, maybe what you didn't like, so that way we can make these podcasts as good as they can be. You can also follow us on Instagram at Vortex Nation Podcast. We'll be posting about each episode released, so that way you can go back, find these things, maybe grab a little nugget of information that you can take with you to the range, out in the field, or maybe to the kitchen if we're talking about some good food. So, again, everybody, thanks, and happy hunting and shooting. We appreciate it. Have a good one.